and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with how much modern politics are driven by who is telegenic rather than who is competent, and look into how New York's Governor Cuomo was seen as a rising star in the Democratic Party, whereas Governor Inslee of Washington State, who did a much better job handling the pandemic than Cuomo did, came off poorly in the Democratic primary debates. Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week, who is the co-host of At Left Anchor podcast, joins us to discuss his latest article at The Week, Cuomo and Inslee, a COVID-19 tale of two governors. We'll assess the extent to which the need to find a telegenic Democrat to counter Trump's domination of the airwaves was misguided, now that the public is finding the ordinary Biden a welcome change from Trump, and how different the TV version of Cuomo is from the newspaper version of him. Then we'll investigate the sharp rise in racist violence against Asian Americans and speak with the founder of Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate, Dr. Russell Yong, a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University and author of Sustaining Faith Traditions, Race, Ethnicity, and Religion Among the Latino and Asian American Second Generation. His group has received an alarming 3,795 reports of racist incidents against Asian Americans tied to the COVID pandemic, made worse by Trump, who made no distinction in his racist remarks between the Chinese people and the Chinese Communist Party government of Xi Jinping. Then finally, we will speak with Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research, about her testimony last week before Senator Whitehead's Senate subcommittee investigating the dark money influence behind judicial appointments and the inordinate influence of Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society. We'll also examine reports now surfacing that the FBI investigation into sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh was a fake. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Ryan Cooper, national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. He's the co-host of At Left Anchor podcast, and his latest article at The Week is Cuomo versus Inslee, a COVID-19 tale of two governors. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York is rapidly falling from grace, but there was a recent period early in the COVID pandemic when President Trump had bungled things so badly and was behaving erratically with these ridiculous briefings that he would give, advising us to drink bleach and shine ultraviolet lights into our bodies, etc. The governor of New York, in contrast, holding his daily briefings, became something of a media star. And a lot of Democratic pundits and pollsters, etc., were talking about him as being a possible Democratic presidential candidate. So, Ryan, does this really speak to the nature of modern politics about whether or not you're telegenic? Because had Andrew Cuomo been on the same stage with Governor Inslee, who ran on that deep bench of Democrats that ran along with Joe Biden, and Inslee came across as a very nice guy, but somehow not very charismatic. But whereas if Cuomo had been on that stage, he might have actually gotten the nomination. You think that's a reasonable supposition, that we're driven by candidates who are telegenic as opposed to who are substantive?
I think it definitely reveals that much in how Cuomo played on the biases of particularly the television media. Alex Perrine has this great article talking about how, like, basically voters are being introduced to newspaper Cuomo who have only ever watched television Cuomo up to this point. And if you're only just watching the news, especially the local news, which is like about the most airhead, you know, kind of superficial, short thing that the forum doesn't really lend itself to anything other than like stuff that is very obvious, very clear, and has like sort of good versus evil, you know, with main characters in it.
Right. And Cuomo, if it bleeds, it leads, is the way they describe it.
Yeah. And you know, Cuomo's failures were all very complicated, you know, not in a way that would be impossible to explain on television, but they would be pretty difficult, you know, in the way that, you know, the sort of conventions of local news go, you know, a 20-minute explanation of all these complicated agencies and like the way Cuomo's sort of hiding kickbacks to people who gave him campaign contributions and so on. That really just never made any headway. And, you know, so I think it's, you know, he's exploiting that balance, the blind spots of the television press. And it also reveals how newspapers have just become totally eviscerated, you know, and New York's probably one of the last places in the country where there are significant, you know, local news to some extent. I mean, you have the New York Times, the one very serious national paper is based there, and they've been paying belatedly a great deal of attention to Cuomo. There's the Times Union in Albany. There's a bunch of local websites sort of hanging on in New York. But, you know, if you're in like Buffalo, you know, it's like you got local news and like, you know, fraudulent conservative websites on Facebook and that's it. And so, yeah, you know, people were desperate, I think, with Trump, you know, just bungling everything. And Cuomo basically could provide liberals a comforting fantasy that the state, at least, was in the hands of someone who knew what he was doing. But and in fact, it was the opposite. And, you know, he was doing very nearly as bad a job as Trump did. While, you know, other people, as I say in the article, Jay Inslee, who was just a sort of like quiet, sort of modicum of competence guy, and just sort of ignored because he wasn't a big showboat who was constantly talking with his own brother. You know, that's another thing Inslee doesn't have, his own brother on cable. And so, you know, it was just a very misleading situation.
But your article points out, Ryan Cooper, that Inslee handled COVID very well in the state of Washington, which was the first state to be hit with the COVID infection.
Yeah, he did. I don't want to overstate things because, you know, by world standards, the performance in Washington State is still pretty bad. But you look at the Seattle metro area and there's, as I recall, you know, as of a few days ago, at least 64 deaths from COVID per 100,000 population. In the New York metro area, it's like 294. So basically five times as bad. And yeah, I mean, as we've seen, you know, like maybe density makes it spread more quickly. There's a possible argument for that. But, you know, the second highest city is Los Angeles, if I'm not mistaken, which is not particularly dense, you know, very sprawly. And so, see, it could have been really bad in Seattle. I mean, much worse at a minimum than it was. And it was because Inslee, you know, he at least tried to do a good job. And for the most part, he did pretty well, you know, like about as good as any governor has done. As you said, you know, before Seattle had the first recorded, you know, clusters, and there could have been others, you know, that just weren't detected. But, you know, the first wave is what got New York the worst and what got a lot of places, because it was before, you know, they figured out like this clever treatments, like turning people on their stomachs so they can breathe better, and like which, you know, types of medication work the best, which steroids can help fight the disease and so on. And so the death rates very initially were really bad. And so Inslee's instinct to just jump on it and you know, attack that, you know, shut down quickly, you know, just like these escalating series of controls that were coordinated with the mayor of Seattle very carefully made all the difference in the world. You know, that was probably, you know, half the reason why it didn't get so bad. Whereas Cuomo was quarreling with Bill de Blasio and like bigfooting his, you know, idea to shut down, only to shut down himself later, and bullying his top scientists and so on. And, you know, it's just that hesitation and dithering was fatal, you know, and by the time he was actually starting to do anything, like that was already probably 30, 40,000 deaths baked in right there.
And again, I'm speaking with Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. He's the co-host of At Left Anchor podcast, and his latest article at The Week is Cuomo versus Inslee, a COVID-19 tale of two governors. So you mentioned Bill de Blasio. De Blasio, of course, has obviously had bad relationships with the governor, which is apparently, now it turns out, almost every other politician in the state did as well. But it's only emerging as these women come forward to talk about his sexual harassment of them. De Blasio wanted to make the schools a priority and to get the teachers all vaccinated so that kids could come back to school. And he just absolutely went up against a brick wall with Cuomo for whatever reason. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I'm not certain. I don't know if anybody knows what's going on there, but the traditional pattern with Cuomo and de Blasio is that de Blasio is basically a sort of a bungler. Like his heart, I think, is in the right place most of the time, but he's kind of apathetic and doesn't really know what he's doing. And he has a terrible relationship with Cuomo. And usually what happens is whatever de Blasio tries to do, Cuomo just instinctively stops him from doing it. You know, I mean, it's part of the reason why he screwed up so bad. He refuses to delegate anything. You know, he wouldn't defer to the scientists. In fact, he bullied 9 of New York's top public health officials and scientists out of government. You know, they resigned. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's indicative of a broader failure of his, you know, quote unquote management style, which is just sort of like compulsive feuding and like control freak tendencies that, you know, you can't sit down and have a rational conversation about what objectives you want to achieve, you know, because you think, all right, you know, what's highest priority here, keeping the bars open or keeping the schools open? And, you know, I think most people will go for the schools. And so, you know, but teachers obviously have a rational desire not to be killed. And so they, you know, it's like you need to spend some money on ventilation and so on and, you know, get things upgraded and, yeah, get people vaccinated first. I mean, those folks should be like at the front of the line, especially now. But, you know, it's like you can't really do anything with a guy like this at the top because it's just it depends on his whatever his whim happens to be, not what, you know, a sort of like reasonable sort of look at what the best priority for the community as a whole would be.
Well, your article also points out the broader issues, which David Wallace Wells has also written about. We'll be talking with him tomorrow on it. The extent to which, just in general, the U.S. has handled COVID, the pandemic, in the most appalling way. Obviously, much of the blame can be heaped at Trump. But now some of it could be also heaped on Cuomo. And in comparison, of course, countries like Australia, New Zealand, Taiwan, South Korea, where they also, and China, of course, China has a lot to answer for. That's a whole other question or a whole other discussion. But is there going to be any kind of reckoning? There's obviously going to be a reckoning with Cuomo. He's obviously refusing to resign, but eventually he will have to go. There's a pattern there, isn't there, Ryan? More and more people come out of the woodwork. The press keeps piling on. And eventually, what do you think this guy's going to do? He seems to be, in his nature, is to sort of tough it out.
Yeah, what, I mean,
what's it going to take? Biden's going to have to ask him to leave. What's it going to take?
At this point, you know, I've always thought that he never would be inclined to resign. And I think what he's learned from Trump is that if you are just shameless enough, and you just refuse to ever back down for any reason, then, you know, 9 times out of 10, you'll get away with it. People will just get tired and bored, and they think, well, maybe if we just let him get away with it this one time, then he'll stop doing the thing, you know, which is like never, ever happens, you know, but is like the easier choice to make in the moment. I think the only way they're going to get rid of him is if, A, he actually is criminally indicted for some kind of obstruction of justice or something. I mean, the Tish James, the attorney general of New York State, is looking into this, as well as the sexual harassment stuff. And so that, you know, I'm not exactly sure what the law is. If you can serve as governor, if you're actually in jail, I don't think so. But, you know, the state legislature could impeach him, you know, and so presumably most Republicans would vote to impeach him. But Democrats have a supermajority in the Senate and they have a majority in the Assembly. And so that all if just the Democrats, you know, were on board with that, I think it would go through. And I think there's this, my sense, I mean, I'm not a politics reporter in Albany at all, but my sense is that so many people are jumping on, you know, and it's a sort of like you come at the king, you best not miss type situation, that they people think he better go down, because if he doesn't, then he's going to be around forever to be a pain in our necks for until the end of time. And he's going to exact retribution on all the people who betrayed him, you know, or, you know, I mean, clearly as you could see, it's like the minute he started showing vulnerability, it's like everyone hates him, but they just were too afraid to say it. But now that they could sort of all stick the knife in at once, they're going for it. And so, you know, I hope that that sort of, you know, the logic of like the Ides of March basically prevails, and they just realize that, you know, they got to get rid of this guy. I mean, he's just dragging down the whole state. You know, and he can't even do his job as he used to do, because it's just nothing but his own scandals eating up all the attention. So it's like, yeah, get rid of him, man. I hope. We'll see.
Well, of course, as you point out, he did write a book. and yet the quote from the book is, show me a person who is not controlling and I'll show you a person who is probably not highly successful. And of course, you point out that 45,000 New Yorkers and New Jerseyans would dispute this definition of highly successful if they were still alive. So that's the bottom line. We really haven't gotten the full picture yet, but he was the guy that seemed to handle COVID really well. But it turned out that the real story is quite different.
Yeah, and the other thing, to return to your original, you know, original question about the sort of blind spots that he exploited, was that I think a common like cultural trope in the, you know, in the United States and in media, you know, books, television shows, and so on, that of the jerk boss, you know, like the guy who's a real just pain in the butt, but gets things done, you know, the cop who won't, you know, he doesn't live up to the regulations, but he catches the criminals, like that type of stuff. And, you know, what it shows is that, I mean, particularly in a pandemic, being a complete jerk is actually a terrible way to govern. And, you know, Rebecca Traister wrote this great article for New York that was, you know, just a long investigation of Cuomo's career. And the take home message is he's always been like that. It's the government's always been a shambles because everyone's terrified, and because he's always hiring like 22-year-old women so they can ogle them and sort of, you know, push them around, you know, and like indulge his like compulsion to dominate others. And, you know, Inslee, on the other hand, it's like you, when you need to coordinate a whole government response, what you need is, you know, an ability to delegate, a good working relationship with all the different players, a small enough ego that you can defer to the scientists to make the right decision, you know, and you know, a little political courage. Because that's another thing that Cuomo is not. He's not a tough guy. He plays a tough guy, because the difficult decision to make that really screwed over so many countries and states in the U.S. is the hesitation, is politicians you didn't want to lead, because you know, here comes this virus. And what you got to do is you got to clamp down quick. You got to get on top of it before it gets out of control. And that means imposing a lot of unpopular stuff, telling people to go home, closing businesses, before there's a demonstrated need to do that, before panic has set in among the citizenry. And Cuomo didn't do that. You know, he waited until it was too late. And it's because, you know, he's a bully, you know, and bullies are not courageous. They pick on weak people. They're not the ones to like, you know, get out there and take some heat on themselves and be like, look, we got to do this. I know it's uncomfortable, but you'll thank me for it later. Instead, you know, he just picks the cheap and easy way out and then pretends like, you know, he's solving the problem that he caused. And it's just, you know, hopefully that cultural trope, it's like, you know, we can erode that a little bit and learn that real competence is not a macho jerk, you know, yelling at people all the time.
So just in the last minute, back to the notion of politics being driven by who's telegenic and who's not. Were the Democrats, in looking seriously at Cuomo, looking for another TV celebrity like Trump? Because interestingly enough, it seems that Biden, being the opposite of Trump, being not being a sort of television creature and a grandstander, and sort of being sort of humble and kind of mumbling and certainly not charismatic, that seems to be working. What do you think, Ryan?
Yeah, I don't know how serious the whole, you know, the speculation that they were going to drop Biden and stick Cuomo in there. I do think that there's been a hunger, you know, among people who, you know, among Democrats and like the left at large, to find someone who is good at getting attention in a similar fashion to Trump, but not maybe not necessarily a sort of media hound dog. You know, and a good example of this might be AOC. You know, AOC is very, you know, popular, especially among like younger people. And she gets a lot of attention, you know, with her Instagram feeds and so on, but not in a way that's just like me. You know, it's a little bit more collaborative and communal, you know. It's not just like, how can I make myself the, you know, my own sort of weird neuroses, the center of attention all the time. And so I think there was some jealousy among liberals about how good Trump was at basically just dominating the news cycle. But yeah, at the end of the day, there's some pretty serious downsides to just doing that and nothing else, you know, like getting media attention, no matter how negative. Because Biden, yeah, I think people are relieved to just have a guy who's not always on TV being crazy.
Well, Ryan Cooper, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post, and he's the co-host of At Left Anchor podcast. And his latest article at The Week is Cuomo versus Inslee, a COVID-19 tale of two governors. We can take a brief station break and back investigating the sharp rise in racist violence against Asian Americans.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Russell Jung, who is a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University and the founder of Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate, which tracks COVID-19 related discrimination in order to develop community resources and policy interventions to fight racism. He's the author of a number of books, including Family Sacrifices, The Worldviews and Ethics of Chinese Americans, Moving Movers, Student Activism and the Emergence of Asian American Studies, and Sustaining Faith, Traditions, Race, Ethnicity, and Religion Among the Latino and Asian American Second Generation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Russell Jung.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And in his recent first address to the nation, President Biden brought up the issue and condemned violent racist attacks on Asian Americans. Your organization has created a database, and apparently, as of February the 28th, there have been an extraordinary number of attacks, 3,795 reports of racist incidents. That includes 503 incidents in 2021. So is your community feeling more threatened? Is this on the rise, this hatred? Because it seemed to spike under President Trump, who made lots of racist statements against Chinese Americans, or that sort of didn't discriminate between the Chinese government and Chinese Americans. So where do we stand in terms of whether this is getting worse?
Well, I think the Asian American community, as you said, is really alarmed. And like many others, I'm outraged to see the attacks against Asian Americans, especially our elderly. When you see the graphic video footage, I just get really angry to see how our society could treat people in such a way. That being said, I think there's two distinct trends that have been occurring. First is the racism from the pandemic last year that was fueled by President Trump's inflammatory rhetoric. And that's been the backdrop for the violence that we're seeing this year, but they're not necessarily hate crimes or crimes that are racially motivated. Asian Americans have long experienced violence like others in communities of color that have high crime rates. So there are two distinct trends. And so you can't necessarily conflate everything as a hate crime, but they are related. And what we're finding in our data, again, we have almost 3,800 cases now, is that the racism against Asian Americans has persisted, surprisingly, even with Trump out of office. We're seeing similar patterns. So women are harassed twice as much as men, and elderly and youth are disproportionately impacted. And so we need to get at the roots of this racism, because even with the change of administration, and even if the pandemic, even as we come out of the pandemic, this type of racism will continue unless we get at the roots.
But I personally find it politically irresponsible, and the idea that the Trump administration, and I guess to some extent the Biden administration, in its dealings with Xi Jinping in China, and obviously there are growing tensions in that relationship, the idea that you, in criticizing the Chinese government, you lump in the Chinese people. I mean, can't our lawmakers and our leaders make the distinction between Chinese people and the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China?
Yeah, I think that's clearly a major part of the problem, that as America China bashes, Chinese in the U.S. get bashed, and people who look Chinese. And so we've always said that U.S.-Asian foreign policy is Asian-American domestic policy regarding race relations. So if we're at war with Japan, Japanese-Americans get incarcerated. If we're having a war against terrorism, Muslims, South Asians, and Arabs get detained and deported. And even now, as we fight COVID, China gets blamed for it. As we have trade wars, China gets blamed for it. And then that scapegoating then gets extended to Chinese Americans. And so it is really problematic. It's hard for people to make that distinction. And I think we need to hold government officials to both develop better relationships with Asian countries and to safeguard the interests and public health and safety of its residents here in the U.S. So you're right. Disentangling the Communist Party from our relationships with China and Chinese people and the Chinese people in the U.S. is difficult for other Americans to understand the distinctions and the relationships.
And in terms of history, I mean, there, of course, was the sort of era of the Yellow Peril. There was the extent to which Chinese laborers were exploited during the building of the railroads, etc., and during the gold rush. So is that, how much is that history of racism against Asians taught in American schools?
Oh, I think the history is rarely taught. You may get a mention of railroads being built and maybe one sentence of the Chinese Exclusion Act. But it's the anti-Asian violence and the Yellow Peril fear has long been part of Asian American history and really impacted our communities. Because we were seen in the 19th century as bringing the diseases of malaria, smallpox, and leprosy, that was the basis for the Chinese Exclusion Act, that and taking away white workers' jobs. And so we were met with that racist policy and over 300 cases of community displacement. There weren't individuals, but entire Chinese settlements being driven out. My own family's fishing village in Monterey, we had over 200 people there. They were burnt out and then evicted. And my family that had been there for 40 years had to move back to San Francisco Chinatown just to feel safe from that type of discrimination. So history is repeating itself again. You have the yellow peril fear of disease and threat to workers' jobs. And that's the exact same fears that have been invoked and mobilized around in the last election.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Russell Jung, who is a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University and the founder of Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate, which tracks COVID-19 related discrimination in order to develop community resources and policy interventions to fight racism. He's the author of a number of books, including Family Sacrifices, The Worldviews and Ethics of Chinese Americans, Moving Movers, The Student Activism and the Emergence of Asian American Studies, and Sustaining Faith Traditions, Race, Ethnicity, and Religion Among the Latino and Asian American Second Generation. So in terms of resources and policy interventions, what are you calling for, Dr. Jung?
Right. And so a lot in the news and what's being proposed are hate crimes legislation, and that's good. But hate crimes only make up about 5% of our cases. Asian Americans are experiencing racism at varied sites and in different forms. So school-based bullying needs to be addressed. And we're promoting ethnic studies to address school site racial harassment. Online behavior is particularly racist at the moment. As we said, Trump's hate speech went viral, and that led to hate violence. And so we need better community guidelines over online practices. We're having our civil rights violated often, and so we really need expanded civil rights protection. For example, if you go to a store, Asian Americans are getting harassed so much, they're not getting safe access to goods and services. And that's a denial of public accommodations. And so we're really encouraging governments to promote and protect Asian American civil rights. And finally, on the federal level, I think, you know, the Department of Justice, they in the past have really done a lot of mediation efforts when groups were in racial conflict or were facing discrimination after 9/11, for example. And so we're really advocating that the government take more proactive steps in mediating conflicts and, again, providing outreach so that people know that racism won't be tolerated and that we're going to safeguard our civil rights.
And in terms of COVID itself, I guess when President Trump kept talking about the China virus and the Wuhan virus, etc., that sort of created a kind of an impression in the minds of Americans that somehow this was a Chinese sort of biological weapon or something. How do we resolve that? Because clearly, Xi Jinping's government has not been forthcoming. And you know, when the Australian government and some of the European governments call for an international inquiry into the origins of the COVID pandemic, the Chinese government was absolutely furious and brought trade sanctions against the Australian government, etc. So would it be helpful to have some kind of inquiry into the origins to, again, separate the Chinese people from the actions of the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China?
Yeah, I think we need both, and that we need both to have an international World Health Organization investigation on how COVID-19 originated and spread. That's clear so that we could address it in future events. And we need to not just look to other countries to blame. At least in the United States, we tend to scapegoat other countries rather than focusing on our own administration's health response. And like you said, you know, President Trump's words and term of Chinese virus really was deadly for Asian Americans, because what it did is it racialized a biological virus. It became a Chinese virus. And then it stigmatized the people. Like you said, it made Chinese people the carriers of the virus. And that association became the implicit bias of people. People made the automatic assumption whenever they saw an Asian person, oh, they're the carrier. And so they would feel triggered. They would go into flight or fight mode. And that's why you see so many people attacking us and telling us go back home, or they go into flight mode and they just sort of visibly, deliberately shun us. So I can't say or impress on people as how much his words matter, because his hate speech went viral. You know, we saw that in social media. His words were used globally. And so we have counterparts in Australia saying Trump's words had an impact in Australia that led to anti-Asian xenophobia. We've had people in Canada say the exact same thing. So his hate speech went viral, and then that led to hate violence. So we in the U.S. need to really hold our government officials accountable about how they use language, how that can incite further racism, and to be more accountable about safeguarding the public safety of our own citizenry.
But as I mentioned in the beginning, President Biden did mention it in his first address to the nation. What more do you feel that Biden should do?
President Biden's initial response denouncing the anti-Asian racism was a marked contrast to President Trump's incendiary rhetoric. And so it was a welcome relief. And actually, for me, really widely appreciated. But as we said, we need to take the next steps to translate the denouncing of racism towards concrete actions. And we need a whole government response, because the racism is occurring not just at the criminal level where we would arrest people, but again, at schools where kids are bullied, at public transit where people get spat upon on buses, online. And so given the varied sites, we need different government bureaucracies and agencies to address it. The Department of Education, Department of Commerce, the Mental Health Departments. And so what we want President Biden to do is issue an executive order giving high-level authority to government agencies to address it and to address it more proactively.
And do you feel that there's any sort of champion that you could name that could help in terms of a public messaging, apart from the president himself?
I think, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris has a major role. But really, what I've seen is the entire Asian American community has really been galvanized. And so pretty much everyone from the grassroots to people in elected office are sounding the alarm, calling attention to the issue and saying we need to protect our elders. We need to promote racial justice and community safety for all. So I don't look for one champion, but I look for the Asian American community and its allies to continue to advocate for more culturally responsive services and more civil rights protections.
But just in closing, as we mentioned earlier, because of geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and the rising hegemon China, even when COVID goes away, assuming that enough people take the vaccinations, the problem's not going to go away, right? Unless the distinctions between the Chinese people and the Chinese government are made clear to all.
Right. You're totally right. There's two main sources of this racism. It's U.S.-China relations, and that China bashing, again, hurts Asian Americans. Secondly, it's that yellow peril fear that Asians are outsiders who deserve to be excluded. And so we need to address both. And the more we can understand that Asians in the U.S. are part of the polity, part of the citizenry, that we belong to this nation and have a place, and that we can be distinguished from the Chinese Communist government, I think that would be helpful. And the more, again, we could improve U.S.-China relations, that would also be helpful. So I think on both sources of this racism, we need to have a better narrative and understanding of who belongs to America and how the U.S. should relate to other nations.
Well, Dr. Russell Jung, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Russell Jung, who is a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University and the founder of Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate, which tracks COVID-19-related discrimination in order to develop community resources and policy interventions to fight racism. He's the author of a number of books, including Family Sacrifices, The Worldviews and Ethics of Chinese Americans, Moving Movers, Student Activism and the Emergence of Asian American Studies, and Sustaining Faith Traditions, Race, Ethnicity, and Religion Among the Latino and Asian American Second Generation. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining reports now surfacing that the FBI investigation into sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh was a fake. 见了你，在你眼睛，我看见了我自己。Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thanks, Ian. It's a joy to be on your show.
Well, thanks for joining us. And last Wednesday, I believe it was, you testified to the United States Senate subcommittee chaired by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. What was the hearing about and what did you testify to?
Yes, I did. I testified before the subcommittee that Chairman Whitehouse leads. Senator Whitehouse has been such a tremendous leader and courageous leader in speaking out about the dark money that has engulfed the U.S. Supreme Court and the nominations process. I focused my testimony on the singular role that Leonard Leo has played in packing the U.S. Supreme Court. That includes his role advising Donald Trump as a, quote, volunteer while his assets appeared to increase, so much so that he was able to pay off his mortgage 22 years ahead of schedule and buy a mansion in Maine on the eve of the vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. And because he was a volunteer, there was no requirement that he provide any financial disclosure of his sources of income during the Trump administration beyond the Federal Society, which he remains one of the leaders of. And I also spoke about how he, you know, has helped marshal some of the groups that then helped run very expensive campaigns to push these nominees of Trump through on the Supreme Court, like Kavanaugh, like Amy Coney Barrett, like Neil Gorsuch, and to keep the vacancy open when Merrick Garland was nominated to fill Justice Scalia's seat after he died in early 2016. And then we also spoke about some of the groups that have played a key role in that, including the Judicial Crisis Network, Judicial Confirmation Network, known as JCN, which is also, you know, basically instrumentality of Leonard Leo and part of his core operations in this effort to pack the U.S. courts and to dramatically change the law, rewrite our rights. And as he told funders a couple years ago, that put America on the precipice of a revival, he called it a revival, of the so-called structural constitution, the likes of which no one has seen in more than 100 years. So that's what I was testifying about.
So was that some kind of theocratic push, this revival of the constitution?
Well, it's not clear entirely. What is clear is that he has, you know, very close ties to sort of a number of people who have a very right-wing views of issues, including women's access to reproductive medicine, you know, including on gay rights issues and more. And some of the people that he has been partnering with, you know, have attempted to, in my view, take those personal religious beliefs that people are entitled to and try to impose them as law, you know, on the rest of America, for example, in the effort to overturn Roe versus Wade and, quote, send it back to the states, many of which have sought to outlaw access to abortion, even in cases of rape or incest. And so, you know, there's certainly a component of the types of nominees that he's put forward who seem to share a desire for Roe to be overturned. But it's much broader than that, because the revival of this so-called structural constitution that he has touted to these donors is really an attack on the 20th century judiciary, which is a Supreme Court that finally enforced the terms of our constitution, including equal protection of the law for school children who were learning under extreme racial segregation, and a whole host of measures that Congress approved that the president signed into law around the New Deal, things like the Social Security Act and Medicare and rules that allow labor unions to organize. And so I think Leo's objective, personal objective, includes, it's my opinion, that it includes this sort of enshrinement of his religious beliefs as law. But also much more than that, in terms of the effort to limit the power of the federal government to respond to the needs of the American people, including through measures involving, you know, things like minimum wage or Social Security, labor rights, and much more. And so it's, I think, a pretty regressive agenda. From a policy standpoint, it's certainly an agenda that someone can have a support for on a personal level. But the idea that this man has played such a central role in picking who Trump picks from, you know, is very troubling, especially because he appears to have increased his assets at the same time that he held this role and took a pay cut from the Federal Society.
And put basically, what, at least five of the current conservative justices on the Supreme Court?
At least five, and the question, and has very deep, close personal ties to the sixth, and that's Justice Thomas, who was confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1991, and who is a close friend of Leonard Leo's. His wife, Jenny Thomas, is a close friend of Leonard Leo's. They've been involved in a number of projects together, Jenny Thomas and Leonard Leo, projects that advance a very extreme right-wing agenda. And she has bragged to her donors and followers how much she has learned from Leonard Leo about, you know, the taste of really expensive wine, how wonderful, how much he's taught them about that, among other things. And he is very much an advocate of the very, in my view, extreme views that Justice Thomas has taken from the bench.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, a deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. Court. So in the hearing, did Opus Dei come up? Because that seems to be the thread here. And of course, Leonard Leo, of course, was very close to the former Attorney General William Barr, who was a moral authoritarian, and he made it clear in his Notre Dame speech that his priorities to sort of revive a kind of moral structure, which sounds like this kind of interpretation of a new constitution amounts to. The other thing that I wanted to bring up, though, since you testified before the subcommittee in the Senate chaired by Sheldon Whitehouse last week, he and others are now bringing up what they're calling a fake FBI report that was, remember, during the Kavanaugh hearings, the FBI had to do a quick investigation into some of the charges that were brought against him, particularly from a woman here in California who, as a very young woman, who had accused the young Brett Kavanaugh, of a sexual assault. Now, it looks as though that FBI report that was done very quickly was a fake. What do you know about that, Lisa?
Well, a couple things. So to respond to your earlier question, Ian, Opus Dei did not come up. And I actually sort of puzzled about what sort of subgroup it is that that Leo and some of his closest compatriots are advancing. It's not clear, but what is clear is that you know, there has been he has advanced some of his closest allies into key positions in government and the courts, and you know, I think it's fair to assume that many of those people share his views. That's why they were chosen. And so I think that that's something worth noting. You know, Brett Kavanaugh is someone who also, you know, comes from that sort of right-wing federal society. Some might call it traditionalist moral sort of set of claims, although in the case of Brett Kavanaugh, you know, he's someone who had a reputation for, you know, heavy partying. And certainly the evidence that came forward in the Senate Judiciary Committee included testimony under oath by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, as you mentioned, that he attempted to sexually assault her as a young girl when they were in high school. There was other evidence that other people who went to college with him sought to bring forward, and that the FBI never interviewed those people. The FBI conducted what many believe, you know, was a real whitewash of the situation. They didn't fully investigate it, in my view, and the view of many others. And as Senator Whitehouse has spoken about or written about today, there's a new request to ask the Biden administration, the FBI, to reopen that investigation and conduct an actual thorough investigation, which would involve interviewing the several witnesses who said they were never called by the FBI as part of that inquiry. And there's actually more that needs to be known about Brett Kavanaugh. He has a lifetime appointment in the Supreme Court, but thousands of pages of documents that show his role in the Bush administration and his role with Leonard Leo have never been provided to the American people, to the United States Senate. And they've been, I think, improperly, in my view, denied by a man who he promoted into a key job in the Bush administration and then now serves as the gatekeeper for access to those materials. And then there's also the material that I came forward and put in the record, asked me to put in the record, which are about how Brett Kavanaugh lied about his knowledge of the theft of files from the United States Senate Judiciary Committee by a Republican staffer, files that turned out to be in his hands, that include memoranda that I wrote and that he testified, in my view, falsely under oath to the United States Senate Judiciary Committee back in 2004 and 2005 or 6 when he was nominated to the D.C. Circuit. So I think there are a lot of issues that remain about Brett Kavanaugh. And he has demonstrated in just the brief time he's been on the Supreme Court how extreme his views are and his behavior in terms of his sort of cavalierness, in my view, toward the rights and interests of a lot of people.
So just to change the subject a little bit here in the last few minutes, since you live in Wisconsin, Lisa, I'm not holding you responsible for Senator Ron Johnson. But I have to say, I cannot believe this man. He's so openly racist. And of course, he made these ridiculously racist comments about, you know, how wonderful the people were that stormed the Capitol and how he wasn't threatened by them and how much they loved the police, even though they murdered a policeman. And of course, he was on a right-wing talk show and he prefaced his remarks by saying, I'm sure this is going to get me into a lot of trouble. Well, it's clear that the guy is grandstanding here and he's trying to get some kind of an attention, and I wonder why, because people are now suggesting maybe he's not going to run again. But he does seem to be really obsessed with Black Lives Matter, which, by the way, there's another, again, your state of Wisconsin, there's another congressman from Wisconsin who made some outrageous remarks on the House floor about how Black families don't have, you know, Christian family values, etc. And that infuriated the congresswoman from the Virgin Islands who took him to task. So is there something in the water in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't think there's anything in the water. I mean, if I could just speak personally about Senator Johnson, not on behalf of an organization or anything, but, you know, it is breathtaking. And as the great columnist, Washington Post, Eugene Robinson wrote, you know, this is a man who thinks that a white mob at the Capitol, as you point out, that overruns police lines, and I'm quoting from Eugene Robinson's piece, smashes windows and ransacks offices, isn't breaking the law. But in Johnson's view, millions of Americans who participated in the Black Lives Matter protests after the murder of George Floyd somehow don't love this country. It's breathtaking, really, how racist the views of Ron Johnson are. He certainly does not reflect, I think, the majority of the views of the majority of people in the state that I call home. And he's someone who, you know, was obviously very ambitious. He married into a very rich family and used that wealth to catapult him into a role as a United States Senator, and a role that I think he has done a grave disservice to the people of the state of Wisconsin through his behavior. The idea that people, you know, who engaged in a violent insurrection of our Capitol, one incited by this president, people who were chanting about hanging Mike Pence, and, you know, finding Nancy Pelosi, people racing through the Capitol with zip ties, people who were armed, and as you pointed out, and everyone saw with their own eyes, were attacking police officers using flagpoles as weapons. You know, anyone who cannot see the violence and insurrection and lawlessness of that crowd is willfully blind. And in this case, it seems that Ron Johnson is blinded by his racism. And Wisconsin already had an unfortunate history of having a pretty terrible senator a while back named Senator McCarthy. And it seems like Ron Johnson is trying to give him a run for his money for being the worst senator from Wisconsin in U.S. history.
And of course, he also, in a Senate hearing, tried to suggest that the mob that attacked, the pro-Trump mob that attacked the Capitol on January the 6th, were in fact imposters, Antifa imposters. I mean, it's just mind-boggling, the idea that anybody that supports the Democrats and supported Biden would attack the United States Senate to overturn a Biden victory. You know, it doesn't pass the logic test. So just in closing, though, is this guy going to go away? I mean, there's some talk that he's not going to run again, but it seems like he's really deliberately provoking attention here. You know, of course, he's all blaming it all on cancel culture and that the left is out to get him.
Well,
so
I think
he's a martyr already of his own stupidity.
Yeah, he seems to be doubling down on the Trump playbook, and that was not persuasive to the people of Wisconsin. It appears in the actually tallied and certified votes in the presidential election. And so it seems like a foolish maneuver for a politician to peddle such grotesque lies. But, you know, he's doing it. He must think that there's money in it for him, for his campaign, for his political future. And, you know, it's up to the people of the state of Wisconsin to decide if he has a political future.
Well, I hope they send him off into early retirement and he has to live off his wife's money. I thank you for joining us, Lisa Graves.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for letting me speak to you in my official capacity and then at the end there, just personally.
Well, you, as a Wisconsinite, I guess you're trying to expiate, right?
Yeah.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief of the Article 3 Judges Division for the U.S. courts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.